this is a part everybody, people always enjoy. This is Noah, who's really cultivated great savvy. You know, he worked on the Hill as a staffer for Senator Kyle, before that for Bob Smith, okay, before he had a midlife crisis. Smith, not Noah.
Still looking forward to mine.
Yeah. Okay, and Noah's always been so astute in giving a reading, you know, of what the Republican lineup was in 2008, where people are just befuddled. Everyone's trying to talk himself into Romney, and I never thought Romney really was the front runner, no matter what the figures were. I didn't think he really was the front runner. But let's hear it from Noah.
Thank you. It's great to be standing in front of friends, some new, and one of the highlights of being here so far was getting to talk to my other fellow speakers from today, everyone except James Wilson, who was on the program last night with Hadley Arkes. It may be the most erudite assemblage I've ever been a part of, and thoroughly enjoyed that. I look at this as a continuation of those conversations that have been going on up until now. The Dean of the Faculty also is here, and I have to apologize for the bad habit that I can't seem to shake of referring to the Republicans in the first person plural. We are a nonpartisan forum here, but I'm a partisan speaker at a nonpartisan forum, so I beg for that dispensation. But it is a conversation that's gone on over the years. The first time I spoke here was right before the 2002 elections. It was an interesting moment, probably the last moment. In an electoral cycle that was destined to go very badly for the Democrats, when it looked like the Democrats might be able to mitigate the damage. In 2002, they were running in the first election after all the bad feeling of the 2000 election with Bush versus Gore. And the initial conventional wisdom, which made sense, was that Democrats would be very motivated for this election. The Democrats stood to do very well. It turned out, though, that 9/11 interceded, and as a result, we were looking pretty strong coming into 2002. The Democrats held the Senate by virtue of Jim Jeffords having committed a treachery that the mainstream media tried to portray as heroism, and the historical record probably reflects that bias. But Democrats had come to control the Senate by malicious means, and We had a lunch in Washington with some of Hadley's friends, and I stood out as a counterpoint, because the feeling in the months ahead of the 2002 election was so gloomy that Hadley decided to invite me up here and give a pep talk. But there was a moment in October when it looked like maybe things weren't going so well for us. The Democrats had at least a plausible hope of a political gain that year based on the scandals with the financial companies. It's hard to even remember what they were. Oh, Enron, that's right. Back before the most recent scandals, that was considered a serious financial scandal. So at a moment of uncertainty, I think I've really had it hammered home to me, and maybe it's that so many of these talks have been before elections. There's so much to be humble about when you're in a position of trying to look ahead and forecast political events. And to illustrate the point, even better than an extended digression about 2002, I just wanted to point out the things that have happened this year that were totally unexpected. If you had said at the beginning of 2011 that none of the following would be a presidential candidate in the end, Sarah Palin, Haley Barbour, Mitch Daniels, Rudy Giuliani, George Pataki, Paul Ryan or John Thune, Mike Huckabee, I think that most people thought that at least one of those people would run. And in fact, based on my reading of what's been said and done and reported, all of them did consider running, but none of them made the race. So we ended up with a field that was somewhat unexpected. Then some unexpected things happened within that field. Tim Pawlenty fell off the track early, and he was someone who most people expected to be part of the mix at the end of this race. Rick Perry got in unexpectedly. Rick Perry tripped over his shoelaces unexpectedly, at least from the vantage point of those who saw him enter the race and assumed he was ready to run when he did enter. After that, you saw, perhaps not totally unexpectedly, but Herman Cain became the beneficiary of Perry not delivering on the promise that most people felt he would fulfill when he jumped into the race. And now we've gone to an even stranger place with Herman Cain, a first-time candidate, sort of like in some ways a Ross Perot drama within our own party, someone who brings the promise of a fresh approach and an unpolitician-like problem-solving mode, but appears once in the race to have deficiencies that may end up convincing almost everybody that they outweigh those benefits. So we are in unexpected times, and I think it makes me humble about predicting what might happen that we can't anticipate, what might not happen that we take for granted. All that said, we do have a fairly high expectation on the race that has developed that Mitt Romney will be the Republican nominee. Perry has elements that might make it possible for him to mount a winning challenge against Romney. He has money, and he has a certain amount of what money can buy in politics, which is skilled staff and the ability to purchase media and skilled media makers. What he doesn't seem to have are candidate skills. And it's not exactly a secret. He's got a lot to prove at this point because it's hard to imagine when he would have felt a more urgent summons to stand and deliver than in the debates he's already been in. Perhaps he thought no one was paying attention to those and they were exhibition games. But it's a serious thing that makes it hard to envision a winning scenario for him. Herman Cain, it would be so foolhardy to predict where this is going to end, but most people just seem to feel that in the end he's not going to be the Republican nominee, and I'm not one who dissents from that popular sentiment. Some people may wish he would be the nominee, but even those are harder and harder to find these days. So it's Romney. Unless Newt Gingrich can do it, that's a rising notion, but still an exotic one. It's hard to see him, given that his campaign has dwindled to a real skeleton staff and really almost like a PR machine that you would associate with a book tour, more than a presidential campaign with skilled operatives and lots of county chairs and locations in key early states. It's hard to see how it really would come together for Gingrich, although as the scandal is, the scent of scandal has settled on Cain this week, the online voting markets that reflect the bets of traders in actual real money political stocks show Gingrich having surpassed Cain. And now in third place for the most likely, but the same markets show Romney overwhelmingly likely to be the nominee. So you start with a situation where Republicans are going to be, on the one hand, having a ceiling on our motivation because very few of us are enthusiastic about Romney, but we are enthusiastic about unseating Barack Obama. And with Romney, we think we have, most of us think we have a pretty good chance to do it. In terms of the other half of the presidential equation, Romney is a hard match for the Electoral College for Barack Obama. And the reason is that Obama is deeply concerned that the environment will make it impossible for him to carry Rust Belt states, Ohio and Michigan, particularly Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, quite conceivably. And he's not exactly in robust health in Minnesota or Iowa or, Illinois he'll always win, but he's hurting across the entire Rust Belt. West Virginia's long gone, Indiana's gone, although he carried it last time, Missouri's gone, although he almost won it last time. So you hear more and more in the reports that are sourced by administration officials and campaign officials about a different strategy, a strategy that relies on the Mid-Atlantic and the Mountain West and college graduates. Turn away from the Rust Belt and the blue-collar voters who've always been relatively more resistant to Obama, and try and win with Virginia, North Carolina, and then sweep the Mountain West, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, maybe even Arizona, and then you can potentially win without Ohio or Florida. He'd still have to hold Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. But to the extent that Romney's the nominee, that confounds the college belt scenario, if you will. By the same token, if Perry's the nominee, I think it's very hard. Romney can put New Hampshire into play. Perry will not put New Hampshire into play. The Midwest is more of an open question with Perry, but I think it's safe to say that we'd have a tougher time in a number of those locations where there are cultural translation problems for a guy like Rick Perry. I think it's another reason for Obama to be very concerned. Obama's latest hope seems to be that they can run the 2004 campaign. As the Democrats' prospects have deteriorated, I'm not the first to observe this. You've heard the shift from portraying the upcoming campaign as 1980. It's going to be 1980 again. We're just going to wait for the good economic news to carry us to victory. Republicans won't even get a hearing when the good economic news takes hold. Then you start to hear about 1996. Well, maybe it won't be the best economy, but the other side's nominee will be lame, and our side will be more popular, and we'll be all right. Now you hear about 2004, and you hear about the anti-Kerry playbook becoming the anti-Romney playbook. And, I've said that, every time this comes up, I feel like it has to be said they have a point. That many of the things that made Kerry off-putting to not particularly political voters, and his indecisiveness, his flip-floppiness, his politicianness, are plenty in evidence with Mitt Romney. And so the Democrats have a hint of an inkling of an idea when they want to make it personal, and I think that it's Romney can see this coming, and probably his main strategy is just going to be to focus on the economy. It's the economy, stupid. And whatever they say when they try and make an issue of his being a fat cat or his being a corporate raider, his being a job destroyer, he will just come back to the economy relentlessly. And I think the Democrats have signaled that they're going to make it as personal as necessary. But I think Romney has demonstrated that he can take a lot of punishment in the political arena, and he'll just keep on coming. So, this is why you have a certain conventional wisdom settling in, and you can see it in the New York Times coming out tomorrow. Nate Silver, their elections guru, has an article where he looks at four scenarios. Good economy, bad economy, Romney, more conservative nominee, and the four cells that would fall under in the little box underneath those four options. If it's a strong economy and Romney, and when I say strong economy, I mean a 4% economic growth is what he stipulates, something that would be recognizable as clear recovery and better than just plodding along recovery, and something that we'd all be happy to see us get right now on a patriotic basis, if not a partisan basis. And the low growth scenario was 0%. So 4% and 4% and Perry, Obama's favorite. 4% and Romney, small edge to Obama. 0% and Perry, edge to Perry. 0% and Romney, big edge to Romney. And there you have the conventional wisdom. And he says Kane can stand in for Perry in these calculations. So subject to what we don't know, we enter the election year in a very positive position. And that carries over to Senate races, and to the extent that we can see the picture through the redistricting haze, House races for control of the House of Representatives, which I'm prepared to dilate on at greater length, Maybe I'll give the thumbnail sketch. Republicans are in very strong position to take over the Senate. The close races for the Senate tend to all break the same way. If you look at the last five election cycles or so, you'll see that big gains occurred because the toss-ups didn't go 50-50. They all went to the same party. In 2010, many would say that we forfeited some toss-ups and turned some of what would have been toss-up races into races where the Democrat got by electing the wrong nominee, nominating the wrong individual, that is. And I think we've had some recriminations over that here. That said, I think we're looking at many fewer of those fierce internal battles in the Senate races. It looks like the three old bulls who face the prospect of Tea Party challenges, Orrin Hatch, Olympia Snowe, and Richard Lugar. Of the three, only Lugar might still have reason to expect a competitive primary. I may be overstating it. In Utah, you can get one of these challenges going very fast. Maine, Snowe seems to be clearly out of danger of a serious Tea Party challenge. Utah, there could be a late entrant who would give Hatch a problem, but he's done a very good job of building conservative support in Washington and money and scaring off his most formidable rival, a congressman, and now a Democrat who was thinking about running against him is also not going to run. So Republicans have had this old bull subplot, and would any races get put into contention by nominating less electable nominees where we have very electable general election nominees. That's probably not going to happen this year for the Democrats. So what you do see is a picture where Republicans have a very strong prospect on the current trend of picking up a lot of seats, taking the Senate, and perhaps taking it by more than a little. It's all subject to Obama being able to turn it around, because many of the same states that are hosting competitive Senate races, like Virginia, like Florida, like Ohio, are also key presidential race states. So the picture for the Senate looks very good for the GOP, but no certainty, nothing to bet the House on. And in the House, the redistricting haze is even hazier than I think was anticipated. I made a list of the states where redistricting has turned out to be either surprisingly tough on incumbents, like California, Illinois, where the affected incumbents are Republicans, and Ohio, where it's almost certain that the losing two seats are going to pit pairs of incumbents against each other. And you have chaos in Arizona. You have very late process in New York. And Florida is another state where there are so many seats at stake, and the process is bound up with probably a contested process involving the courts and both the minority and Republican factions in the legislature. The redistricting picture is even hazier than one would have had reason to think it would be at this time. That said, it is a Republican country. And there's probably a natural Republican majority, and the safest bet, given the balance of power in those big state legislatures, is that the changes from redistricting would be a wash, and the Democrats would have a very tough time unless they change the environment. That same intangible consideration I alluded to, talking about Senate and presidential. But if Obama could really catch fire, maybe the Democrats could pick off enough vulnerable, newly elected Republican freshmen to tip the balance and win the chamber back, but it has to be considered an extreme long shot, even in their best case scenario, where they got a modest bump from redistricting and where they ran the table in terms of the races that they seriously challenged. The one thing that they're doing better than they should be in is raising money. They've outraised the Republicans, even though we're the majority party in the chamber, and that, I guess, that says something about what Nancy Pelosi is really good at. Now that she's not busy being speaker, she's become a full-time fundraiser, and she has some aptitude for that as her sole occupation. But all of which is to say, it's a fairly promising political outlook, but it's driven by events that unsettle us. So it's hard to be celebratory, but I think there's something to be quietly reassured about from your Republican vantage point that that we'll end up in a place where the ideas that we favor will come to be more plausible to enact. The one thing that I'll just anticipate, because it would seem to be a logical question at this point, is the super committee, the policy wild card in Washington right now. They've done a good enough job keeping secrecy that I guess that they're still talking frankly with each other. The fact that the process hasn't broken down is a good thing, but it is tough to see how those divides on policy between six Republicans who have the implicit trust of the Republican leaderships in the House and Senate and six Democrats who have the implicit trust of Nancy Pelosi and company are going to come to shared terms on significant changes in entitlements. And substantively, of course, the big reason for that is that they've made a tax increase their essential condition of coming to a big deal, and that is an absolute do not do item for Republican members like John Kyle, Rob Portman, Patrick Toomey, the Senate folks on that committee. The House people may give the Democrats a little more hope. They've got Fred Upton from the Commerce Committee, who's seen as somewhat more perhaps amenable to overtures from the centrist faction, which is one of the guises of the tax increase faction. But the problem is that the liberals might not let the centrists have enough operating room to do a deal that could bring in a Fred Upton, because the Democrat base is fairly hot right now, fairly agitated right now. And I don't think that the Democrats in Congress feel like they can risk, with all of Obama's problems with the base, I don't think they feel like they can risk a financial deal that enrages the base. So I'm not optimistic about the super committee, but again, I know enough about what I don't know about their process and the discussions in there to say that it's possible they could come up with something. There's definitely been some interesting developments in the sense of who wants the committee to succeed and who wants it to fail. The late word is that the Republicans have arrived at a late realization that Obama wants the process to fail, so maybe we want it to succeed. And it's not just a matter of being kind of reactive, zero-sum politicians, although they are politicians, and we all understand that kind of knee-jerk reaction, but trying to figure out maybe what he knows that we don't know and rethink our premises accordingly. His team seems to have suffered from some rose-colored glasses in their assessment of their prospects. Clearly, they have to tell themselves a lot of consoling and hope-inspiring stories to keep themselves motivated, because events are very bleak for them. But they do have a proven track record of showing aptitude in the electoral environment, and they think that it's far from clear that our people have comparable talent, and they are going to try to press their advantage on these policy points, even though in some ways it's dishonorable, and sometimes you'll hear little hints that they know it's dishonorable to pit Americans against Americans. It's the only horse they've got, and they're going to ride it. So we'll see where it takes us. But that is that is where I think I should leave it and open it up to the discussion.
Okay, good. Thanks, Tom. Good questions.
Ethan?
Yeah, two questions. How will the shifting electoral votes further south and further west generally potentially benefit the Republican nominee? And who do you see potentially as a running mate if Romney were to be the nominee?
The running mate probably should be Marco Rubio because he's appealing, because he's he puts an attractive face on our party and presents ideas in a way that makes our party its most appealing version of its case. What we don't want to do is convince ourselves that this Cuban American from Florida is going to be the ticket to big gains in the Hispanic vote in the Mountain West, because I don't think that's true. And I don't think we should I think Rubio is a Florida play, and he's a youth and excitement and fresh face play in terms of branding for the party. I don't think he should be looked at, though, as a Hispanic play, at least in a bet the farm on it kind of way. And you know, I guess that feeds into the census question. You know, it adds heft to this slice of states that Bush mostly won in the Mountain West, and that Obama's going to try and pick off, and he got most of them, except for Arizona. He got them all last time. So it is important. Those states still have, Hispanics vote in less than their proportions of the population, so it's a lagging impact in the electoral arena. But yeah, the good news is those are states that have a history of voting more Republican than not. And if our nominee is conscientious, the Kerry electoral count and the Obama electoral count would be less in the new electoral configuration after this latest census. And I think it's about six or seven that they lost that they had in those elections. So there's definitely promise for GOP in that development, but it's bound up with states that are still swing states, so that the benefit has to be earned in the election. There's very few states that are part of it. Well, Texas gaining two wasn't a bad thing, but I'm not. But Mississippi, I think, lost one, so it's not. It has to be earned in swing states, I think. Dave?
Yeah, I have two questions. One is just to save me some time looking up the facts myself. If you could give us a quick scoring of the number of, in the Senate races, number of incumbents seeking re-election from the party, and the number of resignations or seats that will be open currently occupied by either party.
The
second question has to do with on the tax question that the super committee is taking up. The Republicans have been adamant that they'll tolerate no tax increase. There seems to me to be some confusion, though, about whether they would endorse a comprehensive-type tax reform that would, it's going to raise tax revenues, hopefully it will raise tax revenues because we want to have growth and a larger economy. Would they endorse that if they closed the door on that?
I think that in concept, people are amenable to that. All the politicians in both parties use that rhetoric, the rhetoric of we should be reducing complexity in the code, special favors in the code, and broadening the tax base so we can generate more revenue without general tax increases. But when you get to specific deductions, you're in a much more contentious place, and nobody gets to specific deductions. So the question is the super committee going to do what normal politicians in the normal course of their business don't do, which is more than just pay lip service to the goal, but actually go after the constituencies that protect those Phillips in the tax code. I don't think that you can do it and get a clean, timely getaway, which is what I presume politicians are going to make a precondition. You can't have tax reform on the scale of what a dedicated tax reform commission could produce in this time-shortened process with all the other considerations that are loaded onto this committee. And this was a committee that wasn't necessarily assembled it has a lot of tax expertise on it, but it wasn't assembled for that purpose. You'd be taking a vehicle that wasn't designed for that purpose and asking them to produce something as ambitious as the 1986 tax reform and politically even tougher to sell, because you'd be going after things like health insurance deductibility through employment, equalizing that tax preference so you can deduct your health care money whether you get it on the job or not on the job. That's a huge fight. And I don't think Patty Murray, the Democrat chairwoman of the super committee, would go for that in a million years. But even if she did, I don't see them being able to take something like that on. And what was the other question?
The first question had to do with the composition of the Senate races.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. There have been six or seven Democrat retirements so far. Webb, Lieberman, you have Herb Cole and Jeff Bingaman retiring in swing states. One that probably leans Republican, Kent Conrad's seat in North Dakota. And the only Republican retirement so far is Kay Bailey Hutchison, oh, and John Kyle. And the Democrats' prospects for either of those seats are really poor. Democrats' best prospects in the Senate are against two incumbents who have never been elected in regular elections. Dean Heller in the seat that John Ensign vacated early. And he's in a tough matchup with Congresswoman Shelley Berkley, where she's the better politician, and she's coming from the media center, and she's going to have more money. But the state seems to be in a very anti-Obama mood right now, and that gives Heller probably, on balance, an edge, even against all those factors in her favor. And then here in Massachusetts, with Scott Brown versus Elizabeth Warren, who's coming on very strong. And with Brown, there's been a sense on my part that he thought it was going to be easy. And for a while, it really looked like it would have been. And if Elizabeth Warren hadn't come along, perhaps it would have been. But she's proven very effective at getting money from elsewhere in here for this race. And he needs to step up his game, because right now he doesn't look like he's up to the job of beating off, fending off a challenge as serious as the one she's mounting. So right now, I'm watching that one with a lot of concern. I think we have the edge in the Nevada one, but those are our protects. Democrats have a long list of seats to protect. It starts with an open seat in Hawaii. I mentioned some of the other retirements, but also incumbents like Claire McCaskill in Missouri, John Tessner in Montana, and Ben Nelson if he chooses to run again in Nebraska. And then, as I said, all the open seats I mentioned are seats that Republicans could potentially make a play for: Connecticut, New Mexico, Wisconsin, definitely North Dakota, who are strongly favored there, and then the incumbents in Florida and Ohio. Bill Nelson, who's a journeyman and not particularly daunting, and Sherrod Brown in Ohio, who's to the left of Bernie Sanders, and is going to get a serious challenge from Josh Mandel, the state treasurer there. So Republicans have a lot of targets, and Democrats just have a couple. So we're really on offense there.
I quit the Texas, your friend Ted Cruz.
Yeah, Texas is a great race to pay attention to, even if it's not going to affect the overall score in the Senate, because the battle is in the Republican Party. It's between, in some ways, it's reminiscent of the Crist versus Rubio primary that ended with Crist leaving before the voting. In Texas, Ted Cruz is up against Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, who has maybe even more political gifts than Charlie Crist started out with. Dewhurst is a popular lieutenant governor. He's got a huge personal fortune, and he's got a lot of connections in Texas state politics. Our friend Ted Cruz is the insurgent, and he is running as such, working the many county GOPs and Tea Parties, and trying to generate excitement that he can use to generate national interest. And he's had decent success raising money, and can plausibly say, if he manages to maintain his current level of performance, that he will have the money to get his message out. Dewhurst may outspend him, but Ted will have the money to get noticed and paid attention to. Other conservative candidates have dropped out of the race, and Ted has really consolidated his hold on the conservative place in that race. And in fact, there's another establishment candidate who may draw from Dewhurst. What Dewhurst will probably have to do is try and go negative on Ted and suggest ways Ted is not as conservative. If Ted's done his spade work well in the precincts of Texas, he'll get the benefit of the doubt, because he'll have cultivated the support of enough people to that Dewhurst's attacks won't take, and then Ted will have a real fighting chance to win the primary. But he's certainly an underdog at this point.
Is that right?
Yeah.
We have other questions.
No, I,
last few years, you've mentioned at least the word Tea Party once. Could you comment on the change in influence, which perhaps is indicated by the fact that you haven't talked about them? And also, what do you think is going to happen with Lieberman's seat? The chances for David Walker, if that would make three potential candidates for that seat.
Right. In the Connecticut Senate race, Republicans were disappointed in the last cycle because we thought we had that seat dropping into our laps, but Chris Dodd, who was a damaged incumbent, didn't run again, and they substituted in Richard Blumenthal, and despite our highest hopes about his exaggerating his military record and Linda McMahon having big money to spend, in the end it wasn't close. Now we have the other Senate seat coming open with Lieberman's retirement, and it's Linda McMahon looking at it again, as well as ex-Congressman Chris Shays, who's from the part of the state closest to New York City and has a good reputation with the press and as a moderate. And McMahon coming back again with her money. Didn't do it last time, but here she is, and she may have the ability to bludgeon any competition within the Republican primary. And it all adds up to a serious underdog proposition. But I think anybody who's is tuned into the pro-Israel frequency, as I am, has to be looking for a way to salvage it, because, first of all, it's been such a strong source of support for our causes with Senator Lieberman. Second of all, Chris Murphy, who's the Democrat frontrunner, is he's a J Street candidate in the lexicon of the Jewish world. He's backed by the George Soros created J Street organization, which means that there's only so many serving politicians who are willing to say that they back President Obama's policy of pressuring Israel and putting daylight between America and Israel. But we know that the Democrat frontrunner Chris Murphy is one of them. So I'm looking for any way we can win that. And the other question.
Well, the Tea Party.
Yeah, I think the Tea Party won. The Tea Party won.
Yeah, but in this campaign, how much are the candidates beholden on the Tea Party? What kind of influence do they have?
I think it's by looking at what's happened with their targets in the Senate, Hatch, Lugar, and Snow, you can see that they've lost some of their the implicit threat that they brought to the political arena, and they've lost the some of the sense of implicit support that they could bring to an insurgent candidate, and I think that's affected the calculations of people who are thinking about jumping in as Tea Party candidates. And I think they were somewhat abashed by the results in Nevada, and with Sharon Angle, and Delaware with Christine O'Donnell, and as much as I hate to admit it, Colorado, where we also probably could have won a seat if we hadn't gone with the Tea Party back candidate. So I'm not sure what if it really speaks to their strength and having been incorporated, co-opted into the Republican larger cause, but I'm sure there are some people who are disappointed that it's no longer as easy to take on a strong established incumbent as it appeared to be, as it seemed to be last cycle. And losing the Alaska Senate race also was sobering. That was one where we kept a Republican seat, but only after conservatives got spanked. And that was the trade there. We still ended up with someone voting for Mitch McConnell, but it was someone who we, as conservatives in the party, had effectively lost a lot of our sway with. So that's sobering too. George?
If it's Romney as a Republican nominee, it seems to me that there will be two potential problems that haven't been discussed yet. One is the perhaps unquantifiable Mormon factor. If only a small percentage of the electorate decides that they don't want a Mormon in the White House, that could swing some states. And secondly, what is the possibility that Ron Paul or someone will defect at that point, if it's Romney, and run a third party ticket, thereby, as in 1992, dividing the non-Democratic vote?
I mean, it wouldn't be the same as in 1992. In 1992, it was a centrist challenge that played to people who were disaffected with our nominee from the same direction as the other party. In this instance, you'd be talking about how many voters would waste their vote. It's more like Pat Buchanan in 2000. And frankly, I think that Pat Buchanan going in with the Reform Party apparatus behind him was a more, and George Bush, who was not exactly seen as a conservative, I think there was more running room for Pat Buchanan than I see for Ron Paul now. So Ron Paul can try it if he wants to, but I think he starts from a smaller base and ends up in a smaller base than Buchanan in 2000. That's my guess. As far as the Mormon factor, I realized that we're guessing. We have no precedent for trying to game out how people will react to this proposition. My instinct is to guess that in the same way as people desert third parties, that they'll desert principles, or however you care to characterize it. They desert absolute statements of belief that would prevent them from voting for a candidate that they'd otherwise want to vote for. I think that's my best guess, is that in the end, very few people who want to vote for the Republican will refuse to do it because he's a Mormon, because of the stakes that most people who vote feel about politics. But it could be a factor at the margin.
Could we infer anything from his father's run? He was governor of Michigan.
Yeah, the fact that he could be elected governor of Michigan.
I mean, Michigan's not a Mormon state.
Well, president of the United States is different, though. I mean, Harry Reid gets elected senator in Nevada. You can point to governors, you can point to senators, and you can point to a lot of different states. Mitt Romney was elected in Massachusetts as a Mormon. But president is different. President is ubiquitous. President is all influential. President is making decisions on a scale of importance existentially that no one else is making. So it's just, I don't think you can, that's all helpful data, but it's not dispositive data.
Is the bias regarding Mormons different than the bias with John Kennedy with Catholicism? Of course, then you had more Catholic voters who were supportive of being that way, whereas you don't have that Mormon base. But I'm wondering if there's been any study about psychologically whether people can cross the line for a Mormon the way, unfortunately, people felt they had to cross the line for a Catholic.
I think all there is intuition, and
yeah.
You know, especially intuition. I'm more interested in the intuition of people who actually remember 1960 than my own intuition. But what you need to do is, I guess, say, do you think that anti-Mormon sentiment now, say in the South or in the country in general, is stronger or weaker than anti-Catholic sentiment in 1960 in the South or in the country?
I think it's weaker.
I guess that's my intuition.
The sentiment was pretty horrible.
Yeah.
The only difference is that there were more Catholics who could pick it up on the other side.
That's my intuition.
Yeah.
Sean, let's see. Sean, did you have something? Glenn, did you have something?
No.
All right. Okay, one more. Okay, we're there.
I have a question.
Could
you comment on the impact of the Occupy folks?
I have not been down to the New York or Washington encampments. I know what I read, and I generally don't trust videos I see because I assume that the evidence is not necessarily. There could be like an ecological fallacy of drawing broader conclusions from some vignette of some individual. The one video that did shock me was the one of John Lewis in Atlanta. Because I don't know if you saw this, and probably many of you did. John Lewis, the congressman and civil rights hero, goes to Occupy. He's a very left-wing Democrat, so they're all getting the memo, and they're all thinking of it intuitively. Why don't I go down and mingle with the base at these Occupy protests? Go during the middle of the day when they're not doing anything bad, and at that point they weren't even doing much bad. So what he encounters is they say the congressman just showed up. Let's give him a chance to address us. And then somebody says, wait a minute, we have a process for this. You can't just be given the chance to hold forth and speak from the floor if you don't go through the process. And they go through 6 or 7 minutes of this this process, and all the while you have the crowd echoing everything that everybody says because they use this crazy amplification mechanism of having the crowd repeat everybody something everybody says. And if you watch Life of Brian, the Monty Python movie, that's what it evokes. The crowd's all, everybody says, yes, we're all independent. Yes, we all can think for ourselves. The one thing you can say about it is it's an instance of some enterprising individual, a crank who wanted to keep his congressman from speaking to a group of people that admired him. But nevertheless, they used the process to defeat the collective, and the congressman left without speaking. And you can watch this on YouTube. I think it's a sign of the movement that it's harmless, least pernicious, and now it's becoming more pernicious. And the most salient aspect of its then was its complete goofy and ineffectual chaos. Now it's a different kind of chaos. Its predominant element is its unlawfulness, and I don't know how many places it's going to end ugly in. It's already gotten ugly in a number, like Oakland and at the edges in New York and Chicago. And the media is obviously playing an incredibly treacherous game by covering them with a completely different standard of accountability than they cover the Tea Party. But people get it, that there's a general level of accountability even for the broader movement, even on the assumption that it's only an extremely truculent faction that's doing most of the vandalism. When you have a vandal faction, you're headed for trouble with public opinion. So I think that it's a kind of an ad hoc mechanism that became a discharge mode for political expression without a lot of political forethought. And so now Democrats are uneasy about it. And there was some uneasiness for us that was comparable with the Tea Party because it also was not summoned by regular political leaders. But at the same time, we had confidence, having taken its measure, that we could trust it and that it wasn't going to burn us. And that trust has been mostly borne out, although you can point to some costs that came with that in terms of electoral outcomes. For them, I think that they're deluded in making the assessment that this movement is good for them. And so I think what they thought about us and the Tea Party, maybe I'm as wrong as they were, and I'm letting partisanship skew my perception of how this is likely to turn out for them, but I think it's going to turn out badly for them because I think I have a clearer sense of who's really out there and what their inclinations are than the Democrats do. But we'll see.
A student had a question. Let's take that.
I was actually going to ask about Occupy Wall Street as well.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, the same question.
I was going to ask about Occupy Wall Street as well.
Oh, okay.
How that could affect Republican economic policy.
You do see some of the Republican politicians trying to work in elements of, well, I understand why somebody might be frustrated right now, and just the faintest nod to a sentiment that there are people in financial services who have had an easier time enduring recent setbacks than others of us have. But I think it's mostly opportunity for us because it's not our base, and as long as we don't try and push it too far, I think it's mostly upside for us and downside for the Democrats.
Wasn't there a telling lesson from the guy who was what playing the drums and he's getting money,
right?
And they wanted to tax him on 50% of his earnings, and he no, that was mine. I earned it, right? Something like that.
The longer they stay, the more problems arise. Problems, I don't think, tend to get solved in that environment. They just tend to proliferate.
I took a speaker to dinner at Valentine the other day because the restaurants were so unreliable. And there's somebody with a sign that said, Occupy Amherst. This was at night when the college
was just taking in anyone from the community to come, to just not charge anything, to just give them a meal, because so many people were without power, right? Here the college is just taking in everyone. It was a, I think, generous decision. I don't know who made the decision, whether it was Biddy or who. And here somebody saying, Occupy Amherst. You know, this is the, what a commentary. Well, no, as usual, terrific. Thanks so much.